Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the November 10th, 2014 edition of the Heretics Hour. I am Carolyn Yeager, your host. Last week, I finished up with the land of Poland and the people of Poland, but did not get to do justice to the Ukrainian-Polish ethnic cleansing of 1943, when they were ethnic cleansing each other, as a matter of fact, not somebody ethnic cleansing them. But I'm not able to fit it in tonight either. I don't think it's a very good fit for tonight, so I want to concentrate on the Czechs tonight. But possibly next Monday I can do it while I clean up some loose ends about the Slavs, because I don't intend to go on with these programs indefinitely. So I think after tonight I will have completed what I mostly wanted to present, and as things might come up, I could pick it up again, maybe under some different titles or something, but I want to, you know, move on to some other things. So that's probably, we'll do some more of it on next Monday, but I can't say exactly what it might be, maybe just a little bit. And I want to announce a donation from William in White Top, Virginia. William is a regular contributor, and I appreciate his support, so thank you, William. And I mentioned, I said on the program announcement for tonight's program that Czech history is very similar to what we've already learned about Polish history. And one point of similarity is the invention of a longer history than they actually have, and ignoring or hiding the fact that the rulers they name as dukes, princes, and kings, etc., were actually serving under the German emperors who ruled the entire territories. And they just take a lot of privileges in stating that they had a state at a certain time, but it wasn't actually a state. They just had some, maybe a duchy, where there was a Czech duke. Past times they were under the, you might say, the dominion or whatever of the German kings and emperors. And they all got along pretty well that way, from what I understand and read. And another similarity between Poland and Czech, and the Poles and the Czechs, is they're undemocratic to the point of really illegal and even criminal, in my opinion, behavior toward their national minorities after said minorities were forcibly annexed into the post-World War I treaty-created states of the new Polish Republic, and then the Czechoslovakia state that was created after World War I. And they were, both groups were given these expanded territories as them being the major majority nationality. I mean, they were designed so that the areas that they that were put together, both the Poles in the one and the Czechs in the other, to be the majority nationality there. So they had the the ability to be in charge and rule, kind of overrule what anybody else would want when it came down to that. So, but they were given this on the promise that they would extend self-government and what was called at the time self-determination to these other groups and allow them to use their own language, their own, have their own schools, keep their own customs or follow them, and have their own organizations and have a lot of their own local officials, etc. This was all under the idea of democracy, which is what World War I was supposed to have assured for all of Europe, to the fall of the monarchies and so on, which were already had democracies, but most of them, certainly Germany was a democracy. But the whole idea is we fought this war for democracy, we all have to follow that. And yet the way these countries were set up, it was very easy for the majority nationality not to do that. And in the case of the Czechs, they were particularly autocratic and repressive. And as we're going to see, since no one wanted to pay much attention to it, or would get, then later on it would get beyond that, when they started paying attention, they wouldn't get beyond the talking stage in doing something about it. It was Adolf Hitler who was forced to finally push through the Munich Agreement to bring relief to the Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia, who were the state of the Sudeten Germans was really very, very bad by that time. And for this, it was all seen as, you know, the, what needed to be done at the time. But since then, our historians have been able to show this in a negative light, which it really wasn't. And this is the understanding that I'm going to bring out today and that I would hope that you listeners will come away with from this program. I'm sure some of you already understand all this and agree with it, but I still think you'll find it interesting because I have looked at a lot of Wikipedia pages on the Czechs in preparation, and I have also read the companion book by Bertram de Colonna, written in 1938 on a visit to Czechoslovakia. His companion book to the book he wrote on Poland in 1939, visiting Poland. And my conclusion is that he gives the correct information in the most concise and interesting way. So I'm going to just read and comment from his book, which is titled Czechoslovakia Within. He is a British citizen, even though his name, Colonna, sounds a bit, what, Italian or something, Latin. But he is a British citizen, and he seems to be a very observant, and he's a fair-minded man, but he has a lot of sympathy for the minorities, both when he was in Poland and when he's in Czechoslovakia. So I'm going to go about it that way. I don't think I'm going to miss anything, because when I see what is put on the Wikipedia pages, and there's, you know, all different kinds of pages, it's similar with what I found with Poland, that while they paint a pretty picture of this great history of the Czechs, you know, and how far back they go and all their great kings and dukes and so on, and they never mention that Germans were there. And they, you know, they're in all these cities and they do all this stuff. But the references for that are very thin. They're very new in many cases, very modern, and there's mostly, you know, Czechs from Czech literature and Czech books and so on. So it's not very convincing, but we know that that's what they want the world to believe. So it's another case of these close neighbor Slav people, Slavs, the Czechs and the Poles, of trying to create for themselves something that they don't have, and they're highly, highly nationalistic. Now, the thing we're going to find out about the Czechs is that it appears that most of the Czech people were quite satisfied with the way things were all the way, even through World War One, and the nationalist fervor that supposedly that the nationalist Czechs have tried to portray as being a part of the Czech people going all the way back was just basically something that affected very few, these highly nationalistic politicians. And they wrote all this stuff and they formed organizations and they you know, tried to make out that there was a grassroots desire for this. But in fact, there never really was, but they still were were the leaders of the Czech people. Same with the Poles. They followed these leaders and voted for them, and if they could vote, I mean, if there was a vote, or allowed them to lead them into along these lines, even though they themselves didn't ever express that they were dissatisfied with their relationship with Germany and the Germans. So I'm going to move right into this book, and I'm going to be reading it, but commenting and so on as I go along. So I'm going to start with the introduction. I'm going to read some of it directly from the site, and some of it I've just taken notes from it and have it on my note page here. So I'm not going to do all of it. I hope I can finish what I have here. It's available at wintersonenvende.com/scriptorium. /English/archives, and then you'd be able to find everything that's there. But this one is titled Czechoslovakia Within, and he writes this as two words, Czecho-Slovakia, because he sees it as it was, too, as two nations put together into one, or two majority peoples. And then of the whole, the Czechs were the majority over the Slovaks, so the Czechs even were able to outvote and rule over overrule the Slovaks, who are much more easygoing and less demanding people than these Czechs, who, as I said, not all of them, but the ones who were running the show. So we start with the introduction. I'm just going to, it's not too long, but it's really interesting. It gives some very good background information. I think it's worth reading. Czechoslovakia is a state in the center of Europe. And remember, this is being written in 1938. He always is referring to 1938. So I think that, you know, he was there in the, I don't know, early to mid part of the year, and then he was writing all this up, and then it got published at the sometime still in 1938 in England. Czechoslovakia is a state in the center of Europe whose existence dates from the Versailles Treaty. It is a country without a coastline and possessing no rivers from source to mouth. Its largest river, the Moldau, is a tributary of the Elbe. If we are to go by the handbook of Central and Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia's chief port is Hamburg. Well, that's where they would, that's the closest, you might say. The Moldau belongs geographically to the Elbe system. Czechoslovakia's lack of coastline makes the country comparable with Switzerland, though the compactness which characterizes the latter country is lacking. On the one hand, the state is bound by the Carpathians, Carpathian mountain range, and Poland, which makes, you know, a natural boundary. On the Hungarian frontier, there is no natural barrier. The borderline cuts through an area extensively populated by Hungarians. Czechoslovakia comprises the provinces of Bohemia, Moravia, Silesia, or Silesia, Slovakia, and Carpathian Ruthenia, all of which formerly belonged to the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, which only collapsed just, at the end of the war. It consists, in fact, largely of the remnants of the old dual monarchy and inherits problems implicit in the merger of a number of widely differing peoples into one state marked by an ethnographic Babel, capital B. Every accusation brought by England against the Austrian monarchy in pre-war days is applicable to an even greater degree against present-day Czechoslovakia. In the old days, there was at least a personal touch, such as our country knows, and the Kaiser Franz Joseph had a wide popularity. Today, the only symbol of unity is the artificial constitution promulgated after the cessation of hostilities. There are no traditions to hold the various parts of this politician-made state together. Czechoslovakia is not an economic entity. Her main river belongs to the German Elbe River system. Her border provinces belong both geographically and economically to other systems, what we would think of as other nations, actually, other population groups. A glance at the map shows the artificial geographical nature of the state. Its frontiers have no historical or geographical justification and are the results of arbitrary demarcation. So now we're going to chapter one. Czech historians base their country's right of existence upon the belief that Bohemia has from time immemorial been a Czech province. According to them, it was annexed by the Habsburg dynasty at the end of the Middle Ages. Its historic frontiers, they say that its historic frontiers enclosed a far larger area than do those of the present day. So here we get started, see, with the Czech historians making things up here. First, that the Habsburg dynasty took over the provinces that the Czechs were in. They had been there for a long time, for ages, and their frontiers were even greater than what the present-day Czechoslovakia. That's how they imagined things to be. And they try to back it up, but it's not very historic, you know, it's not very convincing historically at all. I don't know who believes it, except the people who today want to give more, you know, keep the Czechs in power where they are, keep the Poles in power, and keep the Germans down from what is really rightfully theirs. So the peace of Europe, he says, has been threatened during the last few months by the fact of the Czechoslovakian question. The real crux of the matter is not the land hunger of any bordering state, but is in reality the unnatural formation of the country. In addition, the Czechs have failed to carry out those conditions of the peace treaty, which alone permitted the creation of their national state. For the last 100 years, Czech historians have endeavored to make the world believe that Bohemia is of a comparatively recent creation as a German province. Even the most cursory glance at European history proves it was a German. It was German. But the whole civilization and cult, he says, the whole civilization and culture of the country can be traced to German sources. The first mention of Bohemia in history shows that it was then populated by a Teutonic tribe, the Marcomanni, and you can read all about this in Wikipedia. This tribe occupied a compact area of that part of present-day Czechoslovakia known as Bohemia, which the Marcomanni called Bojerheim, or spelled B-O-J-E-R-H-E-I-M. This was in the 5th century, going back pretty far, 5th century in the Christian era is back farther than you're going to find any Slavic people running anything there. But this was in the 5th century, and the greater part of the tribe of the Marcomanni, the Teutonic tribe, migrated to Bavaria somewhere around A.D. 535. So they didn't all, but the greater part of them moved on west at that time. The similarity between the names Böhmen, B-O-E-H-M-E-N, and Bayern, B-A-Y-E-R-N, the German names for Bohemia and Bavaria, indicates the probability of a common root. So these people came from Bohemia and then settled in Bavaria. And then they named these places. After the Marcomanni had left the country, their place was taken by the Teutonic Langobards, and it was only when they too migrated that Slavs invaded eastern Bohemia and the Prague district. So another Teutonic tribe came, and it doesn't say how long they were there, and I didn't get to actually check that out, find out if I could find out, probably, but then they too migrated on, for the most part, and that's when the Slavs came and took what they probably had left quite a bit of civilization there, you know, quite a bit of something there, and they moved in on it. And archaeological discoveries and local tradition are ample proof of the facts given, okay? And their authenticity has never been questioned by English historians. The authenticity of these archaeological discoveries and local traditions and so on. They've been questioned by the Slavs, but not by English historians, he says. The Teutons, who first reigned in Bohemia, left many traces of their occupation. And then he says, no people has a better claim to its native soil and to national self-determination than the Germans of Czechoslovakia's frontier provinces. Now, the frontier provinces of Czechoslovakia are all that part around the western, from the north, west, and south of, which is called Sudeten, the Sudetenland, where all the Germans lived. That's what he's talking about. The first known state of a wholly Czech composition came into existence in the 8th century long after the formation of a Teutonic state on the banks of the Moldau near Prague and in East Bohemia. Now, these new Czech duchies proved to be extremely bad neighbors. Their fondness for pillage and love of strife was so marked in the first years of their existence that Charlemagne was forced to take punitive action against them. In AD 807, or AD 807, 9th century, the Czech Duke of that time became Charlemagne's vassal. And from that day until 1806, 1,000 years later, from 807 to 1806, Bohemia ceased to have a separate existence but was incorporated as a province of the German Empire. All right, because so the Czech Duke and probably some others too were what was called a vassal of Charlemagne, who was the emperor. There must have been various Charlemagnes because Charlemagne couldn't have lived so long. Its existence, Bohemia's existence during those many centuries, was no different to that of any other German province. There appears never to have been any need for successive German emperors to rule it with an iron hand. The relations between the Dukes of Bohemia and the German Empire, originally founded by Charlemagne, were on a perfectly normal footing and remained so throughout the whole of the Middle Ages. The Czech population appeared to have been fully aware of the advantages conferred by German rule. Law and order were well kept, and individual freedom was everywhere respected to the satisfaction of all men. Even the dukes of the famous Przemysl, P-R-Z-E-M-Y-S-L, that's a line that the Czechs say is one of their great royal lines. These dukes of the Przemysl line ordered themselves as became loyal lieges of the empire. They took their part in the battles and worthily earned the laurels bestowed upon them on so many occasions. The city of Prague of the 12th and 13th centuries was as German as any other imperial city of those days. So he's saying, you know, from 800 AD until 1800, Bohemia was just a province of the German Empire. It wasn't a Slavic nation or a Slavic state. They had some, because there was a large number of Czechs living there, a large Czech population, the Czechs were allowed to have their own sub-rulers, you might say, or whatever, and everybody respected the German Empire as being, as they were a part of that. And it's because it was very comfortable and they did very well with that. He goes on to say, Ulrich von Eschenbach, Reimer von Zwetter, and Ulrich von Freiburg were frequent guests of the Hradschin, a castle in Prague, what's called the Prague Castle, whose architecture could not be more typically Teutonic. There was a king of Bohemia who won for himself a great reputation as a singer of German lieder. German peasants and yeomen tilled the fertile fields of Bohemia and cleared forest lands in their stolid, methodical way, an example followed by their Czech neighbors. Germans brought the plow to Bohemia, introduced the vine, and were responsible for many other agricultural innovations. So the Germans were good neighbors, and they were bringing lots of learning and technology and so on to the Czechs, and the Czechs were following along and picking it up, and that's the way you are a benefactor to a people, not harmful to them. The Czechs took the plow from the Germans, and the German name to this day. A plow in Czechoslovakia is a plough, or plough. Its German name is pflug. The influence of Germany can be traced in many other fields. In the times of the Przemysls and the emperors of the House of Luxembourg, Old Prague was built by German architects whose work was responsible for its present-day interest and beauty. And Prague is a very beautiful city. And the House of Luxembourg is German. Luxembourg is German, and that was a German dynasty. The guides will tell you. Now here we go, like the guides at the Holocaust museums. The guides will tell you that the historic pile known as the Weiz Cathedral in Prague was designed by a Czech named Peter Parla, or Petr, P-E-T-R, Petr Parla. The actual fact is that the architect responsible was one Peter Parler, P-A-R-L-E-R, a Swabian, whose name has been given this non-German intonation by the Czechs. And this is something that we find with the Poles very bad, and we find it now with the Czechs, where today, or at least it was in 1938, if you go on a tour, the guides will tell you that this was a Czech who designed this very famous and amazingly ornate cathedral, Weiz Cathedral in Prague, and just plain lying, because the architect was a Swabian German, and they just give, and this is something that is the way they do things. They change all the names, as many as they can manage to think they can get away with, from German or whatever else it might be, but it's usually German, to a Czech, to a Czech version of the name. They do it all the time. They're still doing it all the time. And make it look like these people were Czech when they weren't. The Emperor Charles IV and his descendants are claimed to be of Czech origin. Of course, they're not. As a matter of fact, this ruler had no Czech affiliations. Charles IV is the most famous ruler of Prague, and you know, he did so much for the city of Prague and built so much and so on. So he's the big one that everybody wants to claim. And anyway, Kelowna says he had no Czech affiliations, nor had he any ambition towards creating an autonomous Czech state. You know, he was in charge of that area, but he wasn't trying to make it separated from the German Empire, and he was German. The motive which underlay his building activities in Prague was jealousy of Vienna and a wish to create what he regarded as a fitting background for his imperial state. Yes, you know how they do. They compete with one another. All this building was in the German manner, for at that time, no indigenous style existed, nor was it desired by the Czechs. That is, that there was no Czech style. There was only the German style all over the area. And German builders, German design architects, and so on. Now I'm going to turn to, that's the end of chapter one. I'm going to talk about Czech artists just for a minute, because I did that with the Polish artists and saying that, you know, the world famous or, you know, really highly regarded and well-known artists are far and few between among the Czechs also. So in looking at what they had on Wikipedia, I found the ones who I either recognized or could see that had some kind of distinction to him. And first I'm going to mention Miloš Forman, who's a film director, and he directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and also Amadeus. And he is Jewish, because he says his mother died in Auschwitz in 1943. He was kind of illegitimate, and he didn't know who his father was. For a long time he thought his father was a certain man, which I'm not even going to go into that now, but he says that because he says that he didn't fully understand what had happened to them, he and his mother, until he was young, I guess, until he saw footage of the concentration camp when he was 16. So when he was 16, he saw films of the concentration camps, and supposedly he remembered that's where they were. That's what it looked like. He didn't really understand at the time. But says his mother died in Auschwitz. I don't know. But during World War II, he lived with relatives, and he later discovered that his biological father was, in fact, a Jewish architect, Otto Kohn, K-O-H-N, a survivor of the Holocaust. If his mother was in Auschwitz, I suppose both his parents were Jewish. And then amongst the composers, musicians, and so on, There is Anton Dvorak, D-V-O-R-A-K, who is very well known and highly regarded. And he lived and worked in the Austrian Empire. So he was Czech. And then in painting, there's a couple of people. Alphonse Mucha, who I'm very familiar with. He was an Art Nouveau painter, designer, and decorative artist. Had a very distinctive style, was very talented, and extremely talented, and put out a lot of work, too. But he's not in the top tier of art, you know, but he's very well known. And so that's Mucha. And another one that I never did hear of before, but is Frank Kupka, K-U-P-K-A. He calls himself Frank since he, you know, went to America or something. But he's a painter. He was supposedly well known in the abstract art movement. And he's one of those color theory abstract painters that Margaret Huffstickler and I were talking about on the music program. You know, doing kind of like exercises, you know, and instead of paintings that evoke any emotion or any feeling in the viewer, they're just exercises. And his were basically in color. I have a quote here. It's interesting. It says his painting, The Yellow Scale, which he did in 1907, completed in 1907, was according to a critic, Kupka's first attempt to come to terms with color theory, in which the result is both personal and successful. He said that although it was a self-portrait, the subject of the painting was the color yellow. So that's it. The painting, and if it's a portrait or if there's people in it or if there isn't people in it, eventually he had his paintings were totally abstract shapes and colors, but I saw a few of them. But, you know, the subject is not the person that's being painted or anything that's painted. The subject was the color yellow. So that's typical of what was going on and how it was thought about until, you know, you were led to believe that if your subject was something real, you know, something in the real world, then you were really far behind the times and you were just hopelessly not avant-garde. And, you know, your subject has to be some kind of abstraction, like the color yellow. And finally, there was one poet that did win the Nobel Literature Prize in 1984, although he started writing poetry way back, so he was quite old by the time they gave him this prize, but that's what they do a lot. And Yaroslav Seifert was his name, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool communist. So I imagine his poetry was about that kind of thing, too. And, you know, there were other names there, but they just didn't ring a bell. They just weren't anybody, you know, important other than to the Czechs. And there were, once again, like in Poland, no architects. There's no famous architects, no even accomplished, not even an architect named. So that's something they don't do. So if you think about all this building that they take credit for, not the artists aren't doing that, but these nationalist politicians do. They take credit for all this building. It couldn't have been done by Czechs because they didn't have the capability to do any of that. So that's just another reason why we know it's German, but we know it's German anyway. Totally German style, totally Teutonic, as they say. So I'm going to now go to chapter 2. Okay, I'm going to read all of chapter 2. You know, these early chapters I'm reading all of, whereas later I'm not going to just give some of the highlights, because they're very important. What's very important to me is to set the tone of the historical questions, you know, and what is true and what isn't true about the Czechs' claims that these were their countries, their nations, they dominated here, they had these old kingdoms and so on that were taken away from them. Like they said, the Habsburgs took away their country from them, you know, at a certain in a certain year just isn't true at all. So I'll just continue reading here. If we are to believe the chroniclers, nobody seems to have noticed the need for a Czechoslovakian state during the Middle Ages. The area in question seems to have been perfectly happy as an integral part of the German Empire. Even in those far-off days, Czech nationalists existed, of course, who dreamed of an independent future and displayed an ill-founded hatred for all things Teutonic. But they were few and aroused neither interest nor enthusiasm among their countrymen. These are the men who today are treated as evidence of a long-felt anti-German sentiment and the desire for Czech national independence throughout the centuries. In other words, they point to these few men who existed even far back there, who were fervent nationalists for Czech independence, and say that from that there was a widespread sentiment amongst the Czech people. But he's saying that there was never any sentiment amongst the Czech people, but just by these particular firebrands, you know. And, you know, I'm kind of used to thinking of nationalists as good, but there's a lot about nationalism that has been very destructive and hasn't accomplished anything good at all, and isn't even realistic. That's the big thing. It's not realistic, and it wasn't realistic for the Czechs. The Czechs never had they never ruled except as minor type rulers under the Germans. They may have given them great titles and lots of pomp and so on, but they were not the true rulers, and they never had a country of their own, an independent country. So they didn't really do very well when they did get one. It seems certain that the Czech people and their rulers were well content with their existence under the wings of the German eagle throughout the Middle Ages. There is no evidence of any Czech complaint. Moreover, during the last century of their incorporation in the dual monarchy. Well, he's saying that they weren't complaining. And they had all the rights of citizens and citizenship, and they, you know, were members of the parliament in Vienna and so on, and Hitler gives evidence of that, what others do too. And, you know, they didn't have anything to complain about. The Habsburgs were very careful, and they paid a lot of attention to keeping their minorities happy and taking care of them and making sure they weren't being mistreated or anything and being fair to all. And as we know, the Germans were the bureaucrats kind of the Habsburg Empire, and they did a good job too in that. They just were doing things to keep things going along peacefully and so on. So these people were not suffering, except that they weren't in charge. That's the only thing some of them suffered from. As is usual, dissatisfaction with the existing conditions and a desire for a separate corporate existence was actually started by a group of ambitious politicians. This start coincided with the publication of Bohemian History. That's the title of a book or something, by Franz Palacki, just over 100 years ago. He exaggerated the importance of the discontented few and appealed to folklore and to what he described as medieval Czech poetry. That's in quotes. This is the same as what the Poles did. I mean, they go back and they find, and they write, some of it is written currently. They write a bunch of stuff. And then say they found it, this belongs back here, and it was written by Czech nationalists or written by Czech people for various times. And it really is all fake. Kelowna says the existence of these verses, the existence of them cannot be questioned, but their authenticity is open to the gravest doubt. In the opinion of most experts, these Grunberg and Königshof manuscripts, or MSS, are clever forgeries. Yet the standard Czech history is largely founded on their so-called evidence. And this is what they found, their claim that they have this history going way back and this yearning for independence of the Czech nation and so on. That's what they use. In a recent speech at Carlsbad, Henlein, now he just brings Henlein in here. Henlein is the very well-known German party leader who became eventually by 1938, and he's talking now about a recent speech, so he's talking about 1938. By then, he was the acknowledged leader of all the German Sudetans who were unhappy with their fate there and trying to get free and be able to join up with Germany. And Henlein demonstrated the mythical nature of Franz Palacki's claim. I wish I had that speech, you know. I don't know what it is, but Henlein's aim was not the termination of an academic quarrel, but rather the ending of propaganda based on a historic fallacy, a fallacy dangerous to the peace of Europe. It is a fallacy which has given rise to Czech ambitions which go much farther than the frontiers demarcated after the armistice. That is, the Czechs continued to want even more than what they had and came up with all this historical fantasy about what they used to have and what they used to be and so on to justify their getting this. He writes, Czech nationalist ambitions were by no means fully satisfied after the loss of the war by the Central Powers, meaning World War I, that they expected a larger share of territory to be accorded to them by their friends in London, Paris, and Washington, is shown by documents produced at the peace conference, by the memoirs of prominent Czech politicians, and by carefully prepared maps accompanying those documents. Again, same thing that the Poles did at the peace treaty. It was claimed that there was a great Czech state in Central Europe in medieval times, which was destroyed by the Germans and which the Czechs wished to see restored. Even President Masaryk, M-A-S-A-R-Y-K, I'm going to pronounce it. I couldn't find a pronunciation for it, so I'm going to pronounce it Masaryk, founder and first president of Czechoslovakia, alleged that successive kings of Bohemia had tried to create a mighty state organization by expansion and dynastic policy in the center of Europe, and that the Czech state under the Luxembourg princes had extended its boundaries to Krakow and Posen and included Hungary, Styria, Lusatia, and last but not least, Brandenburg. Or they're wanting to take Poland. They're claiming parts of Poland. They're claiming Hungary. Styria is eastern, or might not be considered eastern, but I'm calling it eastern Austria. Lusatia is German. Brandenburg, of course, is the province where Berlin is. And then he writes, it will be seen that Masaryk's claim was modest, for he might well have included Holland, Italy, North and West Germany, all of which belonged in medieval times to the same empire as did Bohemia and Brandenburg, meaning the Austrian Empire. His claim, however, would have had to be qualified by the statement that the empire was ruled not by Bohemian kings, but by German emperors. Okay, the World War was welcomed by those Czech firebrands who saw in it the opportunity to persuade numbers of their fellow countrymen to desert the Allies and thus curry favor with the latter. Of course, when the war came, the Czech population were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the Kaiser allowed them to form formations. There was a Czech formation, a Czech division, and there was a division of some of the other groups so that they would feel proud and feel better about fighting. They would be fighting just among their own people, in their own comrades. But what did these politicians of theirs do? They encouraged them to desert their own country that they were citizens of and go over to the enemy, because they wanted to get in good with the Allied powers, with the Britain, France, and Russia, and then later the United States. There's no doubt that the Entente powers were aware of Czech territorial ambitions, even before the commencement of hostilities. The Russian ambassador in Vienna received a memorandum outlining the proposed frontiers of the Czech nationalist state from Dr. Kramář, one of the most prominent members of the Czech movement, sometime before the war. Bohemia was to receive Lusatia and most of German Silesia under a Czech Tsar, whose marches were to be run with those of the father of all the Russias, and a Slav corridor was to run through Hungary as a connection between Bohemia and the South Slavs. Now, this was the work that the Czech nationalists did. This is what they wanted. They had this all worked out for what they were hoping to accomplish and to get. And this was also tied in, you know, where where all the Slavs come together and function together against the Germanics and all the Western Europeans, that they have their own powerful nation. I can't think of what it's called, but something Slavic. So I'll just go on. Romania, as envisaged by Kramář, was to have been even larger than it is today. Hungary was to have been denuded of even more territory than she has actually lost. Serbia was to have received Styria, which is, and Klagenfurt, which is in Austria, good large sections of Austria. Trieste is Italian, kind of, and Pola. South Germany was to be bestowed upon the Habsburgs, together with Hesse-Nassau, Westphalia, and Hanover, which are not south. Anyway, and they were to keep Vienna and the Austrian Tyrol, the Czechs were, I guess, while the whole, or maybe Germany, I don't know, while the whole of Schleswig-Holstein was to be given to the Danes. And as an all-important make-weight, France's security was to be ensured by the fulfillment of her age-long desire. She was to have, at long last, the left bank of the Rhine. Well, these were just these Czech nationalists, you know, putting together their greatest dream, their dream plan, hoping they'll get something close to it, and getting it all prepared and getting all the reasons why and so on to take to the peace conference. You know, it's kind of people fantasizing about what they'd like to have, like making a Christmas, children making a Christmas list or something. He goes on, it will thus be seen that Kramář's plan gave satisfaction not only to his own ambition, but also to the imperialistic longings of his friends. He was not alone in his dreams. Klofach, later to be defense minister in Czechoslovakia, was ready in May 1914 with a plan for the disruption of the dual monarchy, based confessedly on the strategic consideration. At his request, a map was drawn by Hannes Kufner, a former Czech imperial officer, showing the frontiers desired by him. Numerous other politicians, among them one, Waldemar Sis, contemplated frontiers extending far beyond those of today. All of these nationalist aspirations were disappointed by the Allied decision in 1919 to give them only part of what they claimed. So all of what they got, these little Czech people who never aren't even that numerous, you know, who never had anything of their own like that, were disappointed in all that they got. And he says that even this part, even what they did get is not justified by their numerical strength. The total population of Czechoslovakia is about 14,500,000, not more than half of whom are Czechs. They're not all Czechs. Because the whole Czechoslovakia is 14.5 million. And only around half are Czechs. The rest is composed of national minorities, on whom Czechs' rule was imposed by force. The artificial existence of Czechoslovakia came into being in the conference chamber of the Versailles and Germain and so on, and resulted in one half of its population being placed in the position of ruler over the other half, a rule which they have since exercised by means of force and, on occasions, terror. The Czechs' ruling position is not due to their own superior power or ability, nor has it any historical justification. It is due solely to the fact of their having committed high treason during the war by offering their services to the Allies, who were the declared enemies of their own properly constituted government, and to the fact that they formed a strategical outpost for France in her latest conflict with the Germans. The European chancelleries have known anxious hours during the last few months. The Czech question, even more than that of the Spanish Civil War, which was, in 1936 and 7, has darkened the political horizon of Europe. Many in England have thrown the blame for the dangers implicit in the situation on Czechoslovakia's most powerful neighbor. We know who that is. But there is no real evidence of ill intent on the part of that neighbor. On the contrary, it is the Czechs who have multiplied their provocations of Germany during recent months. This has only been made possible by Prague's belief in the certainty of French and Soviet support. Well, same thing the Poles were doing. They thought these big nations were going to be there to join in the fight. In this case, the French and the Russians. The Czechs still cherish illusions as to the possibility of a future based on the documents and maps referred to earlier. In endeavoring to understand Czech mentality, it must be remembered that this state, negligible in size though it is swollen with imperialistic ambitions and an unceasing urge toward ever wider expansion. Political cartoonists usually represent Czechoslovakia as a small boy with an immensely swollen head and are not far wide of the mark. Well, it's good to point out right here that, you know, this is the way Germany was portrayed later on, you know, later on, and maybe by some at the time, but many people at the time saw what the Czechs were doing, just like they saw what the Poles were doing. And they understood what Germany needed, you know, that Germany was trying very hard to get along and to come to agreements and so on. And these people were being, the Czechs were being just as unreasonable as the Poles because, as was pointed out, they thought they had the support of these big powers. So, and they were just trying to start something, and they thought they would end up with a lot of territory. They did end up with what they never had before, but they weren't even satisfied with that. So let's see. I'm now at chapter 3, and my instructions to myself is to read the first sentences and a little bit of it and skip most of it. And so that's what I will do. But first, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll take a break. I'm going to play Hermann Prey, with a German singer which is some light music and a kind of he was a film star. I don't know if this is from a film or not, and I don't remember the name of it now because I don't have it written down on my studio here. I just picked it out, but it's 3 minutes and 3 seconds, so we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Ein kleines Liedchen geht von Mund zu Mund. Es ist beliebt und das hat einen Grund. Denn es besingt den Liebling vieler Damen, die ihm zuliebe fielen aus dem Rahmen. Und Amor selber hat es komponiert, hat es den schönen Frauen dediziert. Und als bezaubernd klingt und süß singt man in ganz Paris. Du hast Glück bei den Frauen, Bellamy. So viel Glück bei den Frauen, Bellamy. Bist nicht schön, doch charmant. Bist nicht klug, doch sehr galant. Bist keine Heldin, nur ein Mann, der gefällt. Du verliebst jeden Tag dich aufs Neue. Alle küsst du und bleibst keiner treu. Doch die Frau, die dich liebt, machst du glücklich wie noch nie. Bellamy, Bellamy, Bellamy. Ich kenne einen netten jungen Mann, der gar nichts ist und nichts Besonderes kann und den die Damen dennoch heiß verehren, weil er das hat, was alle Frauen begehren. Er macht die anderen Männer ganz nervös mit seiner tollen Chronik skandalös. Er nimmt die Frauen, wie er will, bei ihm hält jede still. Bist nicht schön, doch charmant, bist nicht klug, doch sehr galant, bist kein Held, nur ein Mann, der gefällt. Du verliebst jeden Tag dich aufs Neue, alle küsst du und bleibst keiner treu. Doch die Frau, die dich liebt, machst du glücklich wie noch nie. Bellamy, Bellamy, Bellamy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour on November 10th, 2014. And that was Herman Pray. And I remembered that the reason I liked this song so much, I like the way he pronounces the German language. You know, it's very clear and very nice to listen to the words, the way they sound. So that's what appeals to me so much about him. But this is the only thing of his that I know so far. And I'm sorry that I don't have more information on it. I should do that ahead of time, but I'm not in the habit of thinking about it. So I don't remember to do it. And then I think, well, I'll play this music. And then I don't know anything about it to tell you. But anyway, his last name is spelled P-R-E-Y. And he was very popular during the Third Reich time. And probably afterwards, too. Chapter 3 is about the census and the population figures and so on. And I'm going to read a little bit of this and then just kind of skip through it. I'm not going to go through much of it because this gets pretty tedious with all these figures. But just to give you an idea, the official census of 1930 shows Czechoslovakia to possess some 14.5 million citizens, of whom only 7,400,000 are Czech. Details are furnished later on in this book, pending. They have some index pages with all kinds of charts and figures and so on, tending to prove that even this Czech figure is exaggerated. It is not even that many. It suffices for the moment to accept Prague's own official figures of 7,400,000, but these show that the Czechs number 51.2% of the whole population. And then he thinks they didn't even have that much, so they weren't even a full, but they were the most populous of all the groups, but they didn't have a absolute majority. In considering this alleged fact, it must be remembered that the census was not carried out in accordance with the tongue of the various peoples, but rather on the basis of previous registration of nationality, and that Czech officials were in a position to influence its results by the gentle persuasion they were able to exercise on the various minorities with a view to convincing them of the desirability of acquiring Czech nationality. The fact of this pressure has never been denied. The unreliability of a census of this nature is self-evident. In a case of this kind, the secrecy is as essential as it is in that secret ballot, which is one of the main achievements of democracy. The absence of any secrecy from the 1930 census would lead one to believe that the Czech element was not exactly underestimated. You know, they would go around, and a Czech official would ask you the questions for you to answer about your census. And so people were encouraged to say that they were Czech, because that's what the Czechs wanted to hear. And if you were Czech, then you got you were treated better, you had more job opportunities, and so on. So, you know, that's the reasoning behind all that. It says that there were 2,300,000 Slovaks to be added to the Czechs, taking official figures. So you see there are quite a lot more Czechs than Slovaks. And it talks about the German minorities and where they were and what they were, and it's just not anything we really need to know. The polling, the voting, I don't think I'm going to go on to Chapter 4 now. And I actually have some notes here on Chapter 4. And just a note before I say anything is that Franz Palacki, who I've been talking about, was like a one-man nationalist movement. He and there's going to be more about him, I think. But he was extremely active and worked very hard and did a lot. And there's almost everything. The whole movement was made up of him and what he was doing. I also have another thing I was going to say. It's just that we were talking about Charles IV, and he might come up again. He's so important to the city of Prague and the Czechs. But they want to call him Czech, but he wasn't Czech at all. And they give him some kind of Czech name. But he was from the House of Luxembourg, as I said. And he was born with the name of Wenceslaus. And his grandfather was King Wenceslaus II. That was his grandfather. Wenceslaus is a German name. Anyway, that's just a little note I had there. Now let me get where I was at Chapter 4. What I want to, I'm just going to read from my notes here so that I can get through all this. The first official Czech census took place in 1921. 738,516 Hungarians were recorded, of whom 634,827 lived in Slovakia, while 103,690 were recorded in the Carpathian area. These figures point to the mysterious disappearance of over 30% of the Hungarian population between 1910 and 1921. By a strange coincidence, the population shown as belonging to the Czechoslovak group increased by almost exactly similar percentage. And the Czechs really didn't like the Hungarians. Well, they didn't like anybody. They hated the Germans. They hated the Hungarians. They really wanted to do away with Hungarians. They wanted that territory, though, that the Hungarians that they got from on their southern border there, that's made up of a part of Hungary there. And so going on, I'll just read it. Census papers in Czechoslovakia are filled in a different manner to that customary in this country, where the head of the household does the work himself. Well, I kind of went over this, and this is being repeated now here. In Czechoslovakia, the task is entrusted to special commissioners. In the Slovak census referred to, there were 14,100 of these commissioners, of whom only 594 were Hungarians. So the Hungarians were basically in the Slovakian part of the country. They were a pretty good percentage of the population, but out of 14,000 commissioners who took the census, only 600 were Hungarians. And on the basis of the previous census, the Hungarian minority were entitled to over 3,000 commissioners of their own nationality, not 600. There's evidence to prove that many of these commissioners used pencils in filling up the forms. This method makes it possible, to say the least of it, makes possible subsequent alterations. In many cases, householders were not allowed to see the completed forms, and so could not tell whether the details supplied by them were entered as given. Many of the officials spoke no Hungarian while they were questioning Hungarians, which must have made matters somewhat complicated. Hungarian Jews and Gypsies were set down as Jews or Gypsies without qualification of nationality, so they weren't included as being Hungarian, though their only tongue was Hungarian. Czech ancestry, however slight, automatically rendered a Hungarian Czech. Okay, if you had some Czech ancestry, then, and you were Hungarian, they turned you into a Czech. In an English census, this might be compared to entering as French any English persons of Norman ancestry. What they want to do, just like Poland was doing, is they don't want these minority groups to have any voice and power in the legislative bodies and so on, and, you know, in the government. They want to either turn them into Czech and have them be part of the Czech delegations or whatever, or have them just disappear, just not be represented. Although 38% of the population of Kashaw was Hungarian in 1919, by 1930, these figures had fallen to 18%, from 38 to 18. During the same period, Czechoslovakian figures rose from 14 to 66%. This in spite of the fact that 15 out of 48 elected town councillors were members of Hungarian parties, and 14 more were Hungarians by extraction. The Hungarian population of Ujgorod fell by 62%, while the Czechoslovaks increased by 24%. Devious means were employed by the Czech authorities in order to decrease the apparent proportions. In the 1921 census showed that 20% of the population in the Pressburg area was Hungarian. In order to lessen this proportion, the authorities resorted to cleavage, adding 16 Hungarian communities to the neighboring Galanta area and replacing them by non-Hungarian communities from the Bazin area. Just like redistricting type of schemes that we have here in the United States and probably everywhere. So now I'm going to move to chapter 5. I just read part of that chapter 4. And I'm just going to read from my notes again for chapter 5. Ruthenia is a narrow enclave in the extreme east of Czechoslovakia, bordered on the northeast by Poland, on the southwest by Hungary, and on the south by Romania. It's ethnically Ukrainian. So you see how these people are all crammed in there, different groups, and having to get along with one another. It's not easy. Inasmuch as Ruthenia is a completely self-contained province, it seems a little difficult to understand why its government should be entrusted to Czechs. Ruthenian inclusion in the Czechoslovak state was announced on May 8, 1919. The Ukraine, or Ruthenia, as it was now called, had never any relations with the Czechs. No historical nor ethnographical reasons can be adduced in support of this inclusion. Nevertheless, the Ruthenian Congress held at Scranton, Pennsylvania, on November 19, 1918, decided to throw in their lot with Czechoslovakia on a federal and autonomous footing. The Treaty of Saint-Germain confirmed the rights of the Ukrainians, giving them local self-government by their own elective diet, having jurisdiction over all religious, educational, and language questions. It was also expressly laid down that Ruthenian officials were, in as far as possible, to be of Ruthenian blood. The Czech authorities, however, succeeded in postponing this autonomy on the grounds that the country was not ripe for self-government, and it would require at least 20 years of tutelage. Tutelage by Czechs who had never done, you know, governed themselves either, or governed anybody else either. But they needed to tutor the Ukrainians in doing it. It would take them 20 years. A further breach of the peace treaty was committed in 1926 when the official language of the country was declared to be Czech, and the selection as governors of men notorious for their weakness of character. That is, governors of these other nationalities who had weak characters and would go along with what the Czechs wanted. In almost every case, these governors have been under the thumb of their Czech deputy governors. That is, the governor is not Czech. He is of the nationality that is in that area. But they give him a Czech deputy. And the Czech deputy, tells the governor what he can do and not do. Says the present deputy governor, M. Mesnik, in a particularly intransigent is a particularly intransigent Czech whose desire to absorb Ruthenia is well known. He has been in office for the past 3 years. Well, that's just an example of, you know, what they're doing to these other groups, because I'm going to spend more time on the Germans. The Germans were by far the largest of the minorities, so they deserve that time. But, you know, they were doing the same thing to everyone else. And I'm skipping chapter 6 altogether. It's kind of got a lot of more of this detailed stuff. And now going to chapter 7, again, just reading from my notes, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was a liberal-minded prince who planned to transform the dual monarchy into a federation of national states. He, it was, who fell victim to assassination in Sarajevo. So it was mentioned in here by a Czech named Hadza, who was friendly with him, knew him, that Franz Ferdinand, who was assassinated in Sarajevo, was liberal-minded, and when he became Kaiser, he planned to transform the dual monarchy of the Austro-Hungary into a federation of national states. That's like what Russia is. I don't know if these people didn't know that, or if they didn't care, or they were trying to start a world war, or what they were trying to do, but that's what they did. So going on, Edvard Beneš, he plays a huge role in Czechoslovakia and amongst the Czechs. He's a Czech before the war and during the war and after and even up to World War II and on. So he's a very important figure. But he went to work with a view to the dissolution of the old dual monarchy. See, these people, these Czechs and others, they didn't like it. They wanted to get rid of it because they wanted to control something. They didn't have a bad situation there at all, but they just, you know, they didn't want to be, they wanted to be, as I said before, they wanted to be in charge. They wanted to be independent, and they didn't want to be under the Germans anymore. So Edvard Beneš got his degree in philosophy at Prague in 1908. Entitling him, as is the local custom, to the qualification of doctor. Shortly after this, he became a tutor of political economy at the Czech Commercial School. In 1912, he published a pamphlet dealing with the history of political parties. He was later awarded the title of professor. It was not long after the outbreak of war, 1914, August, before he left his native country. It was his belief that the way to the formation of a Czech national state led over the ruins of the Habsburg Empire. He deserted to the Allies, where he found himself in company with his old friend Masaryk. Masaryk was a very important figure, and a president and so on, leader of the Czechs. Before Beneš, Beneš came after him, and Beneš became more important than Masaryk. But going on, when the first professional Czech government was formed on November 14, 1918, Edvard Beneš was one of its leaders and was the best-known Czech after Masaryk. It was he who claimed the status of a great power for his country, a claim which he has since pursued regardless of the rights or feelings of other nationalities. It was his eloquent voice which persuaded President Wilson to give his vote for the revocation of the autonomy previously granted to the Sudeten Germans. Think about that. He talked President Wilson into revoking the autonomy that they had granted to the Sudeten Germans after the war. Acquisition is easy. The maintenance of what one has acquired is more difficult. Beneš gave his country wide territories, but only at the expense of other nationalities. At Geneva, he forged the links of the chain which connects Prague with France and Soviet Russia. As everybody knows, he became president after the death of Masaryk. Since his elevation to the presidential chair, he has struggled more vigorously than ever to maintain Czech supremacy at any cost, even to the extent of a general European war. Skip a bit here and then pick up once leader of the Sudeten Party. Oh, now we're going to talk about Konrad Henlein, who I've mentioned before as the spokesman for the Sudeten Germans. Once leader of the Sudeten Party only, Konrad Henlein is now the acknowledged leader of the whole German-speaking minority. Oppression rose to such a pitch in 1933 that all the German parties, with the exception of small groups of little importance, began to unite under his leadership. He founded his own party on October 1, 1933, the year that Hitler became chancellor, but later in the year. A month later, he had 7,000 adherents when he addressed a meeting at Reichenberg. By July 1934, his audience had grown to 15,000, and since then have been many times multiplied. 60,000 enthusiastic listeners heard him speak at Haida on September 1, 1935, and he addressed upwards of 100,000 at Teplitz on October 20th in the same year. On April 5, 1934, Henlein developed his views for an assembly of politicians, economists, and representatives of the press. They were, in principle, the same as the now famous Carlsbad 8 points demand of April 23, 1938. His claim to national self-government for his own Germans does not necessarily mean the dissolution of Czechoslovakia. All he asks are fair and just conditions for the German-speaking minority. The Slovak question has become another minority problem owing to the overbearing nature of the Czech mentality. Well, now I'm going to go to chapter 8. I said I should read this whole chapter, but read it fast. Well, I think I need to just kind of explain it and read this last part. You know, it's about the magazine American Mercury that was going pretty strong at that time in the 30s, and this is 1938. He's talking about the present time. He's saying things that the American Mercury magazine has revealed or has written about. Some of it is about the peace treaty back in, you know, 1919 and 20. And I'm going to skip that. And then so much for the claim made by the Czechs that the Sudeten desire for self-determination is of recent growth. Now, here's the thing. That the Czechs were saying that the Sudeten Germans only started asking for self-determination recently, maybe since Hitler came to power or something like that. But it wasn't true, and the American Mercury proves conclusively from this and other evidence that the German protests had their birth at the time of the formation of the Czech Republic. Of course, we know they didn't want to be a part of that republic at all. Their statement made 18 years before the students of last May has proved a true prophecy. So this is from the American Mercury, quoting from it. Not, of course, that all holding liberal views approve of the new republic. In an article in the Daily Telegraph on July 25, 1938, currently, Mr. Lloyd George referred to it as the polyglot and incoherent state of Czechoslovakia and wrote of the incorporation of that state of hundreds of thousands of protesting Magyars and millions of angry Germans. As he is now one of the men who played a leading part in the peace conference of creating this, his opinion is of special interest. He admits that he viewed, even in those days, Beneš's proposed incorporation of the territory occupied by German and Magyar majorities with serious misgivings, and that it was a departure from the principles laid down by the Allies during the war. Lloyd George then requested, so he says, General Smuts to make a trip to Prague and discuss matters with President Masaryk. General Smuts pointed out to the president the grave undesirability of including in the Czechoslovak state a very large, purely Magyar population living north of the Danube. President Masaryk agreed and said he would prefer to waive all claims to the Magyar territory. But, as Mr. Lloyd George describes in his article, Masaryk demanded a small strip of Hungarian territory south of the Danube in exchange. Well, the north of the Danube part was contingent to the Czech country, but he wanted part from he wanted to give that back and take a part from further south that wasn't. Must have been more valuable to him. Most of these facts, like, so it's just like, you know, it wasn't possible to come to an agreement. Most of these facts, like the treatment accorded to minorities and foreigners in Czechoslovakia, have remained secrets until now. But truth will out, and observers in Czechoslovakia are gradually sending to the outside world messages which will not fall on deaf ears. Well, it takes them until 1938 to say these things. July. Even British visitors are now being subjected to annoyance and even ill treatment in this strange democracy. Okay, I've got notes on chapter 9. The primary preoccupation of the Czech mentality is its desire to maintain its dominant position vis-a-vis the other nationalities which go to form the heterogeneous state which is known as Czechoslovakia. It is a fervent wish of every Czech to absorb all the non-Czechs. The Czechs look upon the 3,500,000 Sudeten Germans as alien intruders in their country and visualize their gradual disappearance as a corporate entity. Prague has repeatedly stated its determination to expropriate German-owned land and thus to spread the Czech language to the frontiers of the new state. Of course, the Germans were still speaking German, and they were supposed to be allowed to do that. It was the expressed desire of the Czechs that the Sudeten German areas were included in the new state at the peace conference. It must be conceded that the Czech wish to possess so rich an industrial country was a natural one. Not only did the Sudeten Germans play an important part in industrial affairs, but they were also large landowners in the German-speaking area, while their financial and banking houses had an influence in the economic field commensurate with that which they erected in the field of production. With the object of weakening German economic power, the Czechs started a campaign against this key position. At the same time, the policy of Czech penetration was begun with the object of converting the purely German-speaking areas into mixed districts. Over 1,250,000 acres of German land were expropriated between 1921 and 1932. With the semi-officially admitted aim of weakening the German position, this land was acquired by the state against paid or promised indemnities amounting to a mere fraction of its real value. 96% of this land, all of which had been in German ownership, was allotted to Czech farmers. Think about that! 96%. The German-speaking population lost one-sixth of their land, and the formerly compact German enclave was now dotted with Czech cells. A negligible proportion of the land was returned to German ownership. Well, so, you know, there were certain types of German land that was 96% were taken, and when they expropriated land, then they redistributed it, and a very small proportion was returned to the Germans, and the rest went to Czechs. In the sacred name of land reform, yeah, that's what they called it, land reform, 3,250 German farmers were reduced to the state of laborers, while 18,500 Czech laborers were promoted to that of farmer. The German farm laborer also suffered. According to official Czech figures, there has been an increase of 66,000 in agricultural unemployment figures since this reform. This land appropriation was regarded by the Czechs as the most successful method of German denationalization. They adopted further means to this end. The civil service became predominantly Czech. Czech nationalism was emphasized by the appearance of a horde of Czech police, customs officials, post office clerks, and the like, most of them chosen with an eye to the size of their families. They were soon followed by Czech businessmen and commercial travelers, and attempts were made to introduce Czech working men. Wherever a Czech appeared, a German lost his occupation, whether as official or laborer. In other words, he was deliberately deprived of his means of livelihood. Between 1918 and 1938, 150,000 Czechs were dumped in German-speaking areas, giving rise to a commensurate increase in German unemployment figures. Commensurate, 150,000. And, you know, here I really should point out that Germany was accused, is accused still, Hitler's Germany, of trying to take away the distinctive nationality of the Czechs and of the Poles, and yet they were doing that to the Germans and the others in their states in an extreme fashion. So it's not like these people were innocent people who were being victimized. They were not innocent at all. And when they had the chance, they did exactly what they were complaining was being done to them, and it wasn't being done to nearly the degree. The Germans were very nice to the Czechs. They always had been nice to the Czechs. The Czechs are the most ungrateful people. I'm going to move on to Chapter 11. Now, Chapter 11, the proportion of German industrial concerns in the Republic has already been reduced by 50% through Czech economic action. The Czechs claim that the marked falling off of Sudeten industry is entirely due to the world economic crisis. This is patently untrue. It is correct to state that the Sudeten German industry suffered severely owing to the loss of foreign markets, the more so since the firms concerned were practically without reserves. But it is also true that the Prague authorities made no attempt whatsoever to come to their assistance. Furthermore, Czech industry has not only weathered the storm, but flourished during it. The effects of the crisis on the Sudeten German firms was welcomed rather than otherwise in Czech circles, supplementing, as it did, the governmental policy of fostering Czech industry by the award of public contracts to the exclusion of German firms. Since March of this year, unemployment figures for the whole country have fallen slightly. This is mainly due to seasonal causes. At the end of May, there were 50 unemployed per 1,000 inhabitants in mainly German-speaking districts, compared with 11% to 1,000 among the Czechs, 50 to 11. 3 years ago, the Germans had only 2.5 times as many unemployed as had the Czechs. The May figures speak for themselves. Most countries are aware from their own experience of the terrible results of widespread unemployment. Poverty is rife, closed factories are gradually going to rack and ruin. In many cases, the plant has been removed. There are no openings for the young, many of whom have never worked. Tens of thousands of families find themselves faced with a hopeless future. The birth rate is falling among the Sudeten Germans. To this fact, the Czechs have no objection. The death rate, on the other hand, is rising, which again, no doubt, meets with Prague's approval. It will thus be seen that the distress and poverty of the Sudeten Germans is not mainly due to economic causes, but to political and therefore removable ones. The position is due to deliberate expropriation and oppression aimed at the accentuation of the effects of the world economic crisis on Sudeten German industry. In a letter to the Times of London, on July 15th last, Lord Noel Buxton wrote of the genuine grievance of the Germans. Well, they wait until, 1938 to start talking about this, after Hitler is already talking about doing something about it. And he went on and said, grievance of the Germans is perhaps most easily realized if we compare Czechoslovakia with Ireland. Well, he goes on to say that if this had happened, we would have done such and such, and they wouldn't have waited 20 years. The Irish wouldn't have waited 20 years to have used the threat of force. The Czech reply to all complaints by the various minorities is that the new state is still undergoing formation and change, and that this cannot be accomplished without hardships. Yeah, the hardships are all on the minorities. Since the new state has now been a political entity for nearly 20 years, it would seem that this explanation hardly covers the facts. Now, I've got some notes from Chapter 12, and it says, I'm going to read, the primary preoccupation of the Prague government is the denationalization of all its minorities and their absorption into the Czech whole. If they are allowed to have their way, not only the Sudeten Germans, but also the Hungarians, Ruthenians, and Poles will lose their individuality. Having regard to the clause, Having regard to the clauses of the Treaty of Saint-Germain, this policy on the part of the Czechs is a standing reproach to those responsible for the making of that treaty in the name of justice and peace. In spite of all the evidence, which is obvious to any competent observer, the chancelleries of Europe have as yet taken no action in the matter. It is always easiest to follow the line of least resistance and the asseverations of Czech statesmen who boast of their regard for humanity and its rights makes for pleasant hearing. The Germans who live in the bastard state of Czechoslovakia, he's really getting angry now as he's writing, calling it the bastard state, are made to feel that they are persona non grata. More and more strongly, as time goes on, their circumstances grow worse. They claim the rights of equal citizenship in the new republic. It would seem that their right to political, economic, social, and cultural equality can hardly, in equity, be denied. Their further demand that German-speaking territory shall no longer be regarded as a possible settlement for Czech migrants seems to be justified. Nothing but a complete change of heart on the part of the Czechs can right the wrong done and avert a tragedy. Well, we did have the tragedy. It is hardly surprising that the Sudeten Germans acclaim all who draw attention to their sufferings. The Sudeten Germans do. They welcome the Britons. They naturally feel thankful to Germany for various kindnesses. And their feelings were perhaps best described in the Times of August 1, 1938, in which the report on the way they greeted Hitler at the National Gymnastic Festival at Breslau concluded as follows. And I'm going to read this. This is a report from the Times of London, August 1, 1938. Marching a few steps behind the Sudeten German athletic leaders, in turn came abreast of the Tribune, received the crowd's ovation, the Führer's full salute, and broke out in isolated pairs to grasp Herr Hitler's hand. The gesture, a spontaneous variation on a protracted monotony, unloosed a rising flood of enthusiasm. The succeeding group of Sudeten German girls immediately broke their ranks, clustered around the foot of the tribune, and offered up a wild profusion of bouquets. Herr Henlein held out willing hands, and the bent-down face of the Führer broke into a smile. At that point, restraints were were thrown aside. Marchers incontinently left their ranks, smashing down ropes and barriers, and attached themselves to the widening pyramid of arms and bodies round the Führer's tribune. The posses of Secret Service men were powerless to restore order from the growing chaos. Only the Sudeten German Labor Service Corps, marching in an inner circle of the field, retained a vestige of discipline. Young and middle-aged Sudeten German women, their handkerchiefs to their faces, were the evident victims of fatigue and intense emotion. For an hour and a half, the Badenweiler march beat out its reiterated and unheeded course. An hour and a half. For an hour and a half, the 40,000 Sudeten German athletes spent themselves in an homage such as king or president can rarely have received from the subjects of another state. Well, another state, because these Sudeten Germans were subjects of the Czechoslovakia, but they were giving this huge homage to the leader of Germany. You can understand why, too. Now, I'm going to read that. I say that I should read all of chapter 13. It's about the tourist trade in Czechoslovakia, and it's really interesting. The tourist trade in Czechoslovakia has suffered severely in recent years. Sightseeing tours in and around Prague are constantly abandoned owing to a lack of sightseers. Well, you know, maybe I really shouldn't read this. It's very interesting, but, you know, it's just saying that the tourism in Czechoslovakia is in very bad shape. Nobody wants to come there because they're treated so badly. And it points out all the terrible ways that they're treating their tourists, and they're even suspicious of them all the time and checking their papers, and gives some examples of things that happened to him and some others who told him what happened to them. And he ends up by saying they trust no race other than their own and distrust more especially the racial minorities within the gates. This is hardly surprising, for having once stabbed in the back the country of which they formed part, they are now constantly on the lookout for similar conduct on the part of those they are oppressing. He's referring to them stabbing Austria-Hungary in the back by, well, just treasonously deserting the armed forces there and going to the enemy and fighting on the enemy's side, or maybe not fighting at all, I don't know. But he says the people who do that will then, you know, expect similar conduct from the people in their own country. So they don't trust anybody. Now, chapter 14, I've just got my notes here. So I'll go on to that. Were the Czech state to be deprived of its racial minorities, it would still be a considerable power with a population of 7,500,000. It has never been suggested that Greece, with a population of 6,200,000, is too small to continue to exist. Sweden has 6 million inhabitants, a population considerably below that of Greater London, and manages to exist very comfortably. Denmark, a country where poverty is almost unknown, is a state with 3,750,000 inhabitants. Finland has but 3 million. The Sudetans have 3,500,000. They exceed the population of Finland, even. And Norway, and the Irish Free State, also Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Albania, and Luxembourg. Those are all smaller than the Sudeten Germans with their 3.5 million. So he says there can be no doubt that Czechs, Sudetans, Slovaks, and Ruthenians are sufficiently numerous to form a state each. Political economy appears to raise no objection to such an action, nor is the claim that Czechs and Slovaks are one people tenable. There are much greater differences between the Czechs and Slovaks than there are between Latvians and Lithuanians. The Czech language is distinct from the Slovak, though both have a common root. Customs and ways of life differ widely between the two countries. Now, chapter 15 is about pretty much more of the same, I guess. President Beneš, who is as stubborn as ever. Okay, it's interesting, but I want to get my point. That's the end. That's all I was going to write. I'll just add here that at the end of it, that this headline, you know, the German Sudeten leader, is reported by the Daily Telegraph on July 26, 1938, as saying, "I will never ask my people to accept more promissory phrases. This time there will have to be a real agreement based on genuine concessions by the other side as well as by our own." Then it goes on, I have here, "There was, however, from the very start, but little likelihood of any such concessions being granted. Lord Runciman, the British envoy, was unable to get his way with the stubborn Beneš. The Czech president has an iron will and the usual selfish obstinacy of the die-hard temperament. Many in his country are prone to think that British interests necessarily coincide with those of Czechoslovakia. But this is not so. Again, to quote the Times, Wiedemann, Hitler's ADC, aide, I guess, stated that there were no fundamental differences that need separate the British and German peoples. Everything was capable of arrangement. In the same issue, the Times added, Herr Hitler sent an assurance that the German government were anxious for a peaceful solution of the Sudeten-German problem. And they thought that the British Foreign Secretary expressed gratification at the spirit of Herr Hitler's message. Okay, I'm going to end with what the Germans were doing. This is actually from Wikipedia. It says the Sudeten-German pro-Nazi leader Konrad Henlein offered the Sudeten-German party as the agent for Hitler's campaign. Henlein met with Hitler in Berlin on 28 March 1938, where he was instructed to raise demands that were unacceptable to the Czechoslovak government led by President Edvard Beneš. On 24 April, the SDP, which was the Sudeten German Party, Henlein's party, issued the Karlsbader program, demanding autonomy for the Sudeten land and the freedom to profess Nazi ideology. Now, this is this Karlsbader program was referred to earlier as something that was kind of consistent. It didn't change. These desires, these demands, and of the Sudeten Germans didn't change over all these years. They're still the same. They wanted autonomy for the Sudetenland, and at this point now they included, or maybe Wiki included it, I don't know, but they included freedom to profess Nazi ideology, because I suppose that was outlawed by Czechoslovakia, that the Germans could not belong to that party and they couldn't profess anything about it, and so on. That's what I would assume from that. So it says if Henlein's demands were granted, the Sudetenland would then be able to align itself with Nazi Germany. Then they have a quote from Adolf Hitler's speech at the NSDAP Congress of 1938. Hitler said, "I am asking neither that Germany be allowed to oppress 3.5 million Frenchmen, nor am I asking that 3.5 million Englishmen be placed at our mercy. Rather, I am simply demanding that the oppression of 3.5 million Germans in Czechoslovakia cease, and that the inalienable right to self-determination take its place." So that's pretty well put, wasn't it? So Wikipedia, remember this is Wikipedia, goes on and says, "As the tepid reaction to the German Anschluss with Austria had shown, the governments of France, the United Kingdom, and Czechoslovakia were set on avoiding war at any cost. The French government did not wish to face Nazi Germany alone and took its lead from the British government and its Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. In the meantime, the British government demanded that Beneš request a mediator. Not wishing to sever his government's ties with Western Europe, he was depending on France and Britain, Beneš reluctantly accepted. The British appointed Lord Runciman and instructed him to persuade Beneš to agree to a plan acceptable to the Sudeten Germans. On 2 September, Beneš submitted the fourth plan, granting nearly all the demands of the Karlsbader program." Okay, Beneš submitted his plan, which granted almost all the demands of this of what the Sudeten Germans wanted. Intent on obstructing conciliation, however, the SDP held demonstrations that provoked. See, now this Wikipedia implying that they didn't want to come to an agreement. The Germans didn't want to come to this agreement, and so I can't take that as true. That's the way they present everything all the time. So we just have to hold off on a decision on that, but. They say that Henlein's party held demonstrations that provoked police action in Ostrava on 7 September, and the Sudeten Germans broke off negotiations on 13 September, after which violence and disruption ensued. I am sure that there was something to that. There was a reason for them to do that. It wasn't just because they wanted to go along with the program, although maybe by that time they didn't. As Czechoslovak troops attempted to restore order, Henlein flew to Germany and on 15 September issued a proclamation demanding the takeover of the Sudetenland by Germany. On the same day, Hitler met with Chamberlain and demanded the swift takeover of the Sudetenland by the Third Reich under threat of war. The Czechs, Hitler claimed, were slaughtering the Sudeten Germans. Well, they had been, so what the heck. Chamberlain referred the demand to the British and French governments. Both accepted. If this was a big lie, they wouldn't have done that. The Czechoslovak government resisted, arguing that Hitler's proposal would ruin the nation's economy and lead ultimately to German control of all of Czechoslovakia. The United Kingdom and France issued an ultimatum, making a French commitment to Czechoslovakia contingent upon acceptance. So they were forcing, the United Kingdom and France were forcing Beneš to go along with this. And on 21st September, Czechoslovakia capitulated. He was a very, very stubborn man. The next day, however, Hitler added new demands, insisting that the claims of Poland and Hungary also must be satisfied. I know that he did ask for that. The Czechoslovak capitulation precipitated an outburst of national indignation. In demonstrations and rallies, Czechs and Slovaks called for a strong military government to defend the integrity of the state. A new cabinet under General Jan Serovi was installed, and on 23rd September 1938, a decree of general mobilization was issued. The Czechoslovak army, which was modern and possessing an excellent system of frontier fortifications, was prepared to fight. The Soviet Union announced its willingness to come to Czechoslovakia's assistance. Beneš, however, refused to go to war without the support of the Western powers. You see, that he saw the Western powers as his passport to everything, and he wasn't going to go. He didn't want to join up with the Soviet Union against them. So on September 28th, Chamberlain appealed to Hitler for a conference. Hitler met the next day at Munich with the chiefs of governments of France, Italy, and Britain. The Czech government was neither invited nor consulted. On 29 September, the Munich Agreement was signed by Germany, Italy, France, and Britain. The Czechoslovak government capitulated on 30 September and agreed to abide by the agreement. The Munich Agreement stipulated that Czechoslovakia must cede Sudeten territory to Germany. German occupation of the Sudetenland would be completed by 10th October. An international commission representing Germany, Britain, France, Italy, and Czechoslovakia would supervise a plebiscite to determine the final frontier. Britain and France promised to join an international guarantee of the new frontiers against unprovoked aggression. Germany and Italy, however, would not join in the guarantee until the Polish and Hungarian minority problems were settled. On 5th October, I think it's good that he was helping out those others. They're all being persecuted, and there was no reason to make new agreements with the Czechs when they had done so miserably with the previous agreements. So I can see that once there was an opportunity to make greater gains here, it would have been stupid not to take them. It would have been stupid on Hitler's part, stupid on Germany's part, to just take a little bit and then continue to have problems. So on October 5th, 1938, Beneš resigned as president of Czechoslovakia, realizing that the fall of Czechoslovakia was a fait accompli. Following the outbreak of World War II, he would form a Czechoslovak government in exile in London. Now, I think that you can see from all of the above that I've done tonight that the Czechs were never an independent power that could stand on their own, and they always required support of major Western powers. If it wasn't, they were under Germany for a long time, and then they wanted to be to turn to Britain and France. But they were never able to exist on their own, and that's what Beneš knew, that they couldn't, and that's why he gave up, because he couldn't go against Britain and France, because then who would be supporting the Czechs? Britain and France, therefore, advised Czechoslovakia to concede. It was contended that Sudeten-German grievances were justified and believed that Hitler's intentions were limited. They're saying that the Britain and France thought that the German grievances were justified, which they were, and they believed that Hitler's intentions were limited. Well, I suppose they were. Britain and France, therefore, advised Czechoslovakia to concede to the Nazi demands. Beneš resisted, and on 20th May 1938, this is just a repeat of what I've already said. Partial mobilization was underway in response to possible German invasion. 10 days later, Hitler signed a secret directive for war against Czechoslovakia to begin no later than 1st October. Well, that's where it ends, but it's we know that he just went in and took over Bohemia Moravia, which had been German always. Was you know, we have to remember that. The Czechs just kind of got hold of it. The Czechs got hold of it after World War One, truthfully. And they had control there and for 20 years. And they did a terrible job of it. And they ruined it for themselves. And then they lost it. But they, after World War II, they were again able to convince these powers that now they deserved to have their own state. But they didn't put Czechs and Slovaks together this time. They separated them. And it was just Czechs. And then the Czechs got rid of all the Germans that were still there. We know how horrible that ethnic cleansing was. Well, that's another story. So, ladies and gentlemen, that ends the program for tonight. I'm afraid my that part that I used at the end was not too good. I don't have a clear idea about it, clear things to say about it. So, kind of sorry I went in that direction, but. Still, that was the way it ended at this point. Well, what do we have to say about the Czechs? People will have different ideas about it, but you know, my opinion is not very good. These people are now living on these German cities like Prague and others, and putting out the word and putting out a history that this is all. Was all theirs, and it all belongs to them, and they have a right to it. And really, they don't have a right to it. They're a very small number, but they're probably increasing, trying to increase their population. But they're not an important group of people. They never have been. And that's the long and short of it. So once again, this has been Hitler and the Slavs, Part 5. This is the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Jaeger on November 10th. 2014, and I'm signing off now with our Heretics Hour outro music. Good night.